Welcome into Commerce Experience. I'm your host today, Benji Block. On August 24th and 25th, Bloomreach brought together innovators in technology and retail to drive the AI discussion forward. With visionary keynotes and sessions focused on new and emerging applications of AI, the Edge Summit set out to shape a new future for online shopping from marketing to site search and beyond. I was there for the event live in Napa. I was emceeing the live stream that thousands of leaders tuned into from across the country, and it was an incredible 2 days. Well, today what we want to do is we want to bring you some of the best moments from the main stage at the Edge Summit. You're going to hear 4 clips over the next 40 or so minutes. First, you'll hear from Raj Dadada, CEO and founder of Bloomreach, a session he did called The Upending of E-Commerce, The Start of a New Conversation. Next up, Dr. Raman Chowdhury on the trustworthy AI customer experience. And then you'll hear a fireside chat hosted by Amanda Elam Cole, CMO at Bloomreach, on building a brand through change. Lucky enough to sit down with the creators of Third Love, a bra brand that many of you will probably know and love, Heidi Zack and Dave Spector. And then finally, a portion of the presentation on the Future Commerce AI report, digging into some of the statistics and the findings specifically around this convergence of e-commerce and AI. We have a jam-packed episode, so get ready. Let's dive in. Here are some of the best moments from the Edge Summit from Napa.
We're not going to be talking about all of AI in this next 2 days. It's just too big. We're going to talk specifically about AI in e-commerce. We're going to make this real. We're going to sit at this intersection of AI, e-commerce, and marketing, and we're going to build that blueprint with this industry in mind. And the reality is, 25 years into e-commerce, we've come a long way. It's pretty incredible to celebrate the achievements and see those achievements of this collective industry through COVID and how it literally kept us alive. Well, despite that, the statistic that only 20% of global retail sales happen online, it really bothers me. Why only 20%? And indeed, trust is a big part of the answer, as Dr. Chowdhury talked about. But it's not the only answer. It's basically intuitive to us when we think about why only 20% of purchases happen online. And the reason is, quite simply, we in the tech industry, we in the e-commerce industry, we've made it really easy for people to buy what they were already looking for. That's what we've done. That's awesome. But have we really made it easy for people to shop? I don't think so. I think e-commerce experiences have been built for the searcher. They haven't really been built for the seeker. And when I say the searcher, I'm talking about the person who has something very specific in mind and is looking for that thing online. The world of e-commerce is awesome for that. But more often than not, we're really seeking a solution to a problem, something greater. We're translating those needs in our mind and through our shopping journeys into bits and bytes and queries and clicks. And then we're finding what we're looking for. I wrote a book on this topic called The Digital Seeker, and it really accentuates through a study of almost 100 companies that the winners in digital build for the seeker. They don't build for the purchaser. Let me give you a real world example here, and this is a personal one. This is a picture of our living room at home. And we've had an experience of being seekers, much like many of you had. It's the kind of experience that perhaps you can relate to, which is you move to a new home and your old furniture doesn't fit the new home. Pretty familiar experience for all of us. Specifically, apparently, that brown couch is the problem. I love it, I have to say. But it's a problem because what we're really seeking is a warm and welcoming living room. That's what we're really seeking. And we want to find a way to create that warmth in the living room. But our journey from seeker to searcher, well, it'll probably feel familiar to many of you. We did all the things that you've done. We went on House and Pinterest. We got a little bit of inspiration. We went to a whole bunch of great retail websites. We added products to cart. We de-added products to cart. We copied product descriptions and pasted them into Google. We typed another 300 Google searches and browsed around. 3 hours went by. We probably could have done this more efficiently. Months and months happened. We thought we were going to get it right. We typed in, you know, curved, modern, living room couch, only to realize this is just getting too hard. We got to find an expert. So we did what we've done for hundreds of years. We went to the store. And we talked to an expert who then further helped us refine what we were looking for. That person said, hey, have you considered down alternatives? I hear you have a child with allergies. Oh, what about the setting of the couch? It's got to be a little bit higher. Grandparents are going to struggle to sink into these super modern couches that we all love in pictures. So our needs get increasingly refined. And so here we are. It's been almost a year. And finally, it feels like we know what we're looking for. A modern, average height, lighter color fabric, down alternative couch for the living room, less than $5,000, available in a store near me. It took us about that length of time to identify our search and our needs. That was really the shopping journey. Along the way, by the way, we haven't really picked up the couch, but we did buy that rug. So the journey from seeker to shopper just has a lot of zigzags. It ultimately, if you just step back, it feels a lot more well-suited to a conversation than the maze of online shopping that we traversed. We need a reimagination of the online shopping journey. And we can take inspiration from a different industry. It wasn't that long ago that we used to hail cabs. But transportation was like that for so many years until we recognized that that wasn't really the definition of the problem. It wasn't about finding a better cab. It was really about redefining the problem to go from point A to point B. And enter Uber. Uber revolutionized transportation by solving for the seeker. They brought together so many things: mapping technology, payment technology, a driver marketplace, all of the different pieces of software that had to come together in order to deliver a seeker-centric experience of getting you from point A to point B by redefining the problem, by building for the seeker. But of course, could we imagine Uber and that kind of experience without the mobile phone? No, impossible. The mobile phone was the critical unlock that made a revolution in transportation possible. And all of e-commerce needs that kind of an unlock. But it isn't going to be good enough to just have a mobile phone. Necessary but not sufficient. We need a different kind of unlock, the kind of unlock that allows us to bring high-quality human expertise in literally every category available online to our fingertips. Enter Gen AI. With Gen AI, we're going to be able to design e-commerce experiences that finally solve for the seeker, that solve for the root cause of the problem, not just what we're expressing through a set of searches. Each of us will be able to experience a product expert with literally encyclopedic product knowledge of every product online, and one that might know us better than we know ourselves. It's crazy, but it's possible.
If this were a movie, we would do the like rewind thing and the squeaky noise, and we'd go back to 2017 because I'm having some of the same conversations all over again. Does anybody here remember Microsoft Tay chatbot, right? And this was when that was 2017. Well, guess what? OpenAI's impressive new chatbot isn't immune to racism. That's that first headline. Lenza, which is an image generation AI, is carrying gender bias into the future. So the Lenza one was super fascinating. A friend of mine, Melissa Hakula, is at MIT Technology Review, and she has very Asian looks, and she tried to use Lenza. She has a whole article about this. You should read it. It's really, really great. So she does this thing where she tries to make profile pictures in Lenza. Remember there was that moment where everybody was using Lenza, and all the guys were super excited because it made them look like really cool warriors, and all the girls got to look like super sexy whatever, fairies. So that's what it would do. No, it's 100% true. Like, read Melissa's article. It's great because it's like, great, well, this can be my LinkedIn profile picture. Absolutely not. Because as somebody who looked Asian, it increasingly made her more sexualized and more nude. even though none of her photos showed a lot of skin, and Melissa actually dresses quite conservatively. And it was very shocking to her. And the reason for that is these models are trained off of the data that is available on the internet. So it is a it's actually a misconception that it's built on, quote, the world's data. It's actually untrue. It's built on Reddit. It's built on Common Crawl, right? Everyone starts laughing when I say it's built on. It is built on Reddit, 100%. So what are the images of Asian women that are on Reddit? I'm just going to stop talking right there. So it takes a picture of this woman who is very conservatively dressed, looks Asian, and she wants to make a profile picture, and it automatically gears towards what it has learned, which is this is how Asian women should be portrayed. And again, a lot of the men, their images made them look stronger, gave them like those really great cheekbones that we all would love to have, but actually only exist in our lens of profile pictures. And more recently, there was an example of more explicitly a young woman who was trying to make a profile picture for herself to put on her LinkedIn profile. And it was her literally in an MIT sweatshirt. She's an MIT undergrad. She was Asian, had short, dark hair, and it actually just made her a white woman. That's all it did. It just made her white. And it said, well, this is a more, she actually asked it for a professional photo. Make this photo professional, thinking that it was going to like get rid of her sweatshirt, maybe put her in a button down. No, it actually literally just made her white. So the reinforcement bias of what exists online, what these images are, and how that's being built into the technology is problematic. Because again, we're coding it in this veneer of objectivity because we've slapped a bunch of data on top of things. So we have to look at the fundamental data underneath, which is not actually representative of society. So I worked at Twitter. I led the machine learning ethics team. And while it seemed like Twitter really, quote, captured the world, you know, only 3% of the world population was on Twitter. 97% of the world's population is not on Twitter. And yet it seems like, and it is actually true, that social media platforms like Twitter determine the course of democracy. It is like such a bold statement to say, but it is actually true. The fate of elections and Western, especially Western democracies, are decided on social media platforms. Knowing that, and especially Twitter, which was one of the most politically active social media platforms, 3% of the world's population was on there. So whose voices are in there? What are they saying? And how is that data, again, being increasingly used downstream to build things that seem like they're, quote, reflective of the world, when in reality, they're actually reflective of a very few narrow perspectives? So what's changed? We're no longer in the early days of artificial intelligence. So what's great is we have teams capable of at-scale deployment, because again, this is not just about the technology, it's about the access to the technology. And importantly, we're smarter about the impacts of AI systems. What's really, really amazing is I worked with a lot of reporters from 2017 onwards, and I'm so proud that a lot of them are in these amazing roles. Karen Howe at MIT Technology Review, Kari Johnson at Wired, just to name two, Hayden Field at NBCU, and all these people are really smart about technology. I can 100% tell you everything they write is so well-informed. And that's great, because that means we have a public that is increasingly well-informed. So we're not in this 2017 world of, well, what is AI? Oh my goodness, I'm so scared. We're actually in a world of people being increasingly smarter about algorithmic bias, about data privacy, data security, and wanting to take action, and frankly, rewarding companies that take action to protect them. So what are the challenges? First is navigating these unknown unknowns. So whenever I have a client at Accenture or even today, or people I work with that say, well, we want to talk about algorithmic ethics and algorithmic bias, it seems like this insurmountable challenge, right? Where, well, I have to think of everything, every bad thing that could possibly happen. And it's very difficult to, frankly, it's not an easy task, but you know, folks like myself and other people who work in this field actually know how to narrow it down into the things that are relevant for your use cases. And now the concept of KYC, Know Your Customer, is about responsible and ethical data use. Because again, it's not just that people want this stuff or punish companies that don't have it. They actually reward companies. They give more business to companies that are responsibly using their data and, you know, being more transparent. And it's interesting because we've seen Meta, aka Facebook, make a complete 180 about their transparency. It's fascinating to see them entering the open source market and being more transparent. So if you haven't seen, I suggest going to transparency.facebook.com, transparency.fb.com. They have an entire transparency center where they actually talk through how their algorithms work in plain speak. So I know the team that did that, and they spent months. I mean, it is not easy to explain how algorithms work in an understandable way to everyday people. And for them in particular, a lot of social media influencers are interested in this. People who have children entering the online arena are interested in this. And again, they're actually seeing rewards and more people interested in their platform, which had been not doing as great compared to other platforms. They've seen more people coming back. And again, it's also about having this genuine voice. So people are also worried about this idea of hidden AI systems that are making decisions that impact their lives, and they can't do anything about it. Everything from hiring to loan risk assessment, as I had mentioned, car insurance rates, et cetera. People are increasingly aware that companies are buying data. They have sort of vague notion of this market of data, and their data is being sold, and they can't control it, and they just really want to have some sort of ownership. So I had alluded to this work I had done a few years ago. You can find sort of a plain, there's an academic paper on Archive. There's a longer form article on Sloan Management Review. So this was, you know, a few years ago, but it still holds today. And it's about putting responsible AI into practice. So that one says it's a 7-minute read. I will save you the 7 minutes and sort of talk through, like, what's the takeaway, right? Like, how do we make this TikTok sized, right? So first is tone from the top. How do you build a responsible AI practice in your company? Is first of all, just having clear guidance from leadership. And this can mean building ethical principles. This can mean actually bringing in an ethics officer. This can mean whatever you want it to mean, but clearly articulating from the top that this is a priority in your company, in your organization. This is what you want to be building and doing. And then the rest are actually about putting your money where your mouth is. So second is measuring success. And this actually, to me, as a quantitative social scientist, is one of the most important parts, if not the most important part. We work towards what we can measure, right? Like, as human beings, we're kind of simple creatures. You know, we want to run however many miles. We want to lose however many pounds. We like numbers, and we like working towards them. So when you are creating your performance indicators for teams, how are you building in responsible and ethical use? And I'll give you very specific examples. Often it's the most junior data scientist that has to go munge data, like clean data and do stuff with it. They're actually most likely to people to identify, hey, there could be some data set imbalance, something wrong here. They're also the least empowered to make a significant product decision. So how do you incentivize all of these people who are touching the data and the models, who are the most likely to find problems, but also the least able to make major product decisions, to be empowered to raise their hands and say, hey, so I think we should take a beat and figure out if this data is actually going to help our customers and not be penalized for it? Because frankly, you know, I've run product teams as well. Product teams are incentivized by delivering and delivering on time or faster than on time. So how can you build in performance indicators for people that actually encourage responsible use, encourage that moment to actually review what they're doing and think about it? And also incentivizing your models. Models have an optimization function. Usually that optimization function is something called accuracy, quote accuracy, which is, as a statistician, it's like one of many statistical numbers you can use. It just got the best name, so everybody really latched onto it. But an R-squared is actually a very simple metric that's not actually indicative of what people think it is. So how can you measure your models, your model output in different ways so that it's actually giving you the feedback you want and you're able to track and trace this? I mentioned the ecosystem and the value of internal and external pressure. It helped me a lot internally at companies if I could say, hey, this was guidelines that were built by, you know, some respected authority, right? So for example, the White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy actually have an AI Bill of Rights. Well, isn't it great then, right? So you could say, hey, this is literally articulated by the White House. This is how we should be building our AI systems. It helps be an internal advocate to say, here are external smart voices that are actually aligning with what I'm saying. And then finally, building these teams so it's proximity to product and proximity to leadership. How do you create that feedback loop between product, leadership, and ensuring that, you know, you are mentioning to the company and to your customers that this is how we're building and building responsibly. So what can be done today? That's kind of the important takeaway, right? So if I want to go start doing this right now, one is culture is critical. So I had mentioned earlier about this open source community. People are actually kind of scared of open source. And as somebody who actually built my career programming in R, so before I learned Python, I learned the R programming language. R has one of the best open source communities out there. actually some really beautiful online spaces. And to be a little bit philosophical, even though I was complaining about philosophers in the beginning, you kind of have to trust that human beings are capable of instituting cultures that reinforce our values. We can't just jump to making laws and making punishments. Laws don't work unless we've decided we want to adhere to them. It's actually the truth. Laws work because we are in a law-abiding society. And it's very fascinating. When we look at the open source world, what is the world that has been created absent these laws? And what you'll find is that they actually do have strict culture, norms, and things people do in order to create a safe and comfortable space for a lot of people. So culture is critical. Second is using existing channels of communication for open feedback. So providing ways for people to raise questions anonymously and protected. So, you know, you might have an ombudsperson office where people can raise these questions or, you know, talk about issues that may be coming up in the products that they're building. You know, and also communication channels with customers, employees, vendors. So the big thing I'm entering into is this world of red teaming, or actually structured public feedback. How do I do public feedback, not just as surveys, but actually as targeted product decision making? And it's fun. I'm running out of time, but really quickly, if you want to look up the DEF CON Generative Red Team Challenge, I was part of designing the largest ever Red Team Exercise. We had 2,200 people come in. We had 8 major large language models. So every large language model company was part of this. And our next step is we're taking this data and we're collaboratively working with the companies to write a transparency report that comes out in February. And it was just such a moment in collaborative designing to solve a problem. And it's, you know, it was a wonderful and optimistic way to think about how we can build technology. And last and most importantly, being authentic. I think one thing I will say in my years of working in this field is genuinely being an authentic voice and being honest about what you can and can't do or what you are and aren't doing is really what people respond to the best. So to come full circle myself, artificial intelligence, yes, we are in an amazing, amazing new era. We're almost rebooting many different things that we thought about, but the core fundamentals stay the same. It's about a product, it's about people, and it's about the connections. Thank you so much for your time.
A lot of times when I've heard interviews related to Third Love and you talk about D2C, I think you even said a technology first company. Mm-hmm. Are you a technology company with a retail product, or do you have a retail product and you just really like technology?
So we're a customer first company. And what's super important as a physical products company is that we have outstanding high quality product that delivers on our fit and comfort promise to our customer. Hard stop. Because without that, no amount of technology, no amount of marketing will create customer loyalty. The customer loyalty Dave just talked about comes from creating something that's highly differentiated and that solves customers' problems. That being said, when we started the company, we knew that technology had to be at the core of what we did, and we had to do something different. In the early days of raising money, we got a lot of questions from VCs who were like, why would women buy a bra online? Women can barely find their size in a store. So what are you gonna do? So at the core, from the very, very early days, technology was hugely important. We started with an app that let a woman size herself. We switched to our fitting room over time. So we're both. So my answer.
Well, and I would say too, I think the big insight for us in the early days, especially for this category, but really for any category, and obviously all of us have sort of oscillated between, do we go into a store to buy something or do we shop from home? But then you've got to deal with the return and packing it back up and taking it to the store. And would it be easier just to go into a store and try 4 things on and walk out with 1 or 2 things? And so the big thing for us, especially in this category, which was very fit driven, was how do we bridge the gap between retail and at home so that you can comfortably shop from the security of your house and do it with high assurance that you get something that fit. And so we developed something called Fit Finder, which today has been used by 20 million people. And it absolutely solves those needs. It's not perfect. And the big challenge, which is, it's interesting to be at a conference like this, is that we collect so much data, almost too much. And the challenge is, we were just talking about this backstage, is how do you actually do something useful with all that data? How do you put it to work on your marketing or on your supply chain or something else?
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, you just talked about how important the customer relationship is, and you put personalization at the core of your business early on, and you even talked about it doesn't matter how much marketing we do, though I disagree. I think marketing is very important.
If you want to be profitable, you have to.
Okay.
You know,
all right.
There's that piece of it too, but okay.
Ninos isn't here. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk about personalization and what you, oh, he is. Okay. What does personalization look like for you?
Yeah. So I think what we've always done well is had a reason why our customer would give us personal information. And so it's been a good relationship with our customers from the beginning because we were offering a service. So the way, for people who aren't familiar with how our fitting room works, is it's a way for a woman to find her size and style online in under 2 minutes. And how she interacts with it is she tells us her fit issues. She tells us the brand she's currently wearing, a host of other data points that we collect. And then we offer a size to her and a style recommendation based on what 20 million prior women have told us. And we've gotten a lot smarter along the way. So about 60 to 70% of the time, we're offering a different size recommendation than she thought she was when she started. So that's obviously hugely impactful to a woman. And many women who I meet are like, oh my gosh, I took your fit quiz and it told me I was this different size. I wasn't totally sure. I finally like did it and oh my God, it worked. And so because of that, that's really how we've been able to collect so much important customer data. How we use it well, I would say, is through CRM and email, probably today. There's a massive opportunity for what we should, as Dave alluded to, should be doing with it across platforms that we have not gotten to yet.
I know a company that can help there.
Huh.
And Dave, what a...
Oh, I was distracted. Sorry, man.
Checking out the logos. What is personalization? You talked about returns and profitability. Where does personalization fall into that story?
I mean, we've been on this journey of personalization since we started the company. It was literally one of the three core tenets of why we started Third Love. And so, and again, this was the category to have a personalized experience in, right? And by the way, that was also, which is a huge moat and a big reason why there's a number of large companies out there. And so we saw the fact that if we could bridge that gap and get over that personalization and great product and some other things, we could get over those hurdles. There'd be a big moat around our business for competitors. But for the company today, it really is around creating a highly personalized site experience to the best that we can, using all first party data that we collect from our site, using FitFinder and other things. And then delivering on an experience that obviously when you open the box and other things, is as personalized as you can get it while still being profitable. I mean, we can't do a ton of things at our warehouse to make it personalized and write. We used to do handwritten cards and stuff like that, but we can't do stuff like that anymore. At the end of the day, the more personalized it is, the more it feels like a retail experience, the more you'll want to shop with us online and not want to go into a retailer of some sort. To Third Love today, by the way, we keep talking about online. We have 9 stores. But it is a very small part of our overall business. And so the business has always been very technology focused and led, starting with an online experience, because as Heidi said at the beginning, it all started with this core frustration of not wanting to go into a fitting room with a stranger and get measured. And so it's all about delivering on a personalized experience at home.
Yeah. And I think that is the beauty of D2C for a lot of, I don't want to try anything on in, in the store, let alone intimate apparel. So we haven't talked a lot about AI yet, and we're at an AI conference, but I think let's dig into FitFinder. Dave, when we ran into each other at Lead Summit, and I got to hear about how you guys are doing product development with AI and then FitFinder and the evolution to the virtual fitting room, that you were really early and on the cusp of using AI to grow your business. Talk to us about that.
We were doing AI ML really before it was there was any terminology around it. And we were doing something with OpenCV, if anybody's familiar with it, using computer vision super early as well. And we have a number of patents actually today around the systems that we developed around ML and OpenCV especially. And so the objective was really to take FitFinder and utilize the data from that pump it into a machine learning and LLM, and then output being what's the best size recommendation for you. And then based upon return information, which is sort of the other side of the equation, how do you then figure out whether or not the ML worked? And so if you can put that whole equation together, you end up with a really strong model so that over time, very small increments, your return rate goes down. And then you know you're doing well. And you know that the ML model is working. And so I think the hard part for us is actually how do we add in sort of the AI portion to it? Because today it's really just machine learning based on our own data set. And it's not really a lot of technically AI of what we're doing. But I think we're at the early stages and uniquely, and we're really proud of this, we have a lot more data and a big competitive advantage over anybody else out there, at least in our category, because of this unique first party data that we collect with FitFinder.
And Heidi, when you were talking about the customer experience, where do you think AI and customer experience come together?
I think, well, we talk about one of our values at Third Love is put our customers first, right? It's our fifth value, but our most important. So when we're making decisions at Third Love, if everything, you know, if there's no other lens we go through, it's really about how do we make the right and best decision for our customer? Because I think that will lead us to the right place in terms of decision making. It's really a customer first mentality across every touch point that we have with her. And I don't think we do it as well as we should right now, but you know, I can see a world where we inherently understand her distinct fit issues, where we know she's going, because we're smart enough to have this huge data set of, you know, over 5 million customers. And we should be using that in how we think about both our new and our current customers and their journey with us. So all of lifecycle marketing really should be wrapped around using the data we have to predict, right? And be very clear about not pinging someone at the wrong time. As I like to say, with bras in particular, like, we're not a fashion company, right? We're not dropping new products every day of the week. And a woman isn't looking to buy a bra every day. Meaning, if I target you 365 days of the year, sure, one or two of those days, you're gonna be looking to buy bras and underwear, but I'm just wasting money. Mm-hmm. So how do we think about what are those moments in time in the journey? When should we be more at the forefront? And then with what? With what product, right? And so if we could get there, the world would be very different. So that's my vision.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think all of us, as we talk about what's happening with AI and the challenges that we're seeing and how we think about re-engineering or rethinking our businesses, you all rethought an industry. And I think one of the things that I've really loved about Third Love is the inclusivity of different shapes. Women of all sizes. That was one of your very early campaigns. Can you talk a bit about why that was so important?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'll go back to the early days. In 2012, every bra brand that existed, all they were selling was sexy. There was no bra brand that wasn't doing that people cared about. Think about the Calvin Klein billboards. I mean, Victoria's Secret fashion show. I mean, that was how intimate apparel in the US was sold. Hard stop. There were no brands that were inclusive, none. When we did our first photo shoot, I remember the photographer, because this is how it works, they're like, what brand in the space do you aspire to be like? Because we were brand new and, you know, and we were like, none of them. We don't want to look like any intimate apparel brand. And he was sort of like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? And we're like, we want to have like models of different sizes, and we don't want women pillow fighting, you know, in the shoot, you know, like just basics. And, you know, it was hard. I mean, it was actually hard to even find models who weren't like 34B and, you know, 100 pounds and all this stuff. I mean, you really had to seek it out. I mean, the world has changed dramatically. If you are not inclusive today, like, you are not relevant, right? But that wasn't the case. So it was always really important to us to have that inclusivity. And I think something else that we were talking about earlier was this idea of how do you build a brand that customers love and can relate to? It's by making them feel that they're part of your brand and that they're not alone. And I think women with their breasts and bra shopping oftentimes are like, oh, and I hear this from women, oh, it's just me. Oh, I just have a weird body. Oh, et cetera. And it's always about them and their problem. And I'm like, it's not your problem. It's the brand's problem. Like, it's because someone hasn't created something great for you, or it's because you've been told you're this size and you're not. And so our breast shapes and some of the other things that we have sort of destigmatized this idea that, you know, it's the woman. It's not us. It's what was created for us. So I think from the very early days, it was really about trying to flip that script, which I think we've done a really good job of. And the industry has obviously gotten their act together.
We see a number of reports in the industry about AI in tech, AI in healthcare, AI in finance, but AI in commerce, and specifically in e-commerce as a profession, is something that's been glossed over. This is the very first AI in commerce in-depth report, and it covers a cross-section of professionals in e-commerce, direct-to-consumer, marketplace, and retail professionals whose primary operation is delivering digital experiences to a customer online, and that they have to have day-to-day hands-on-the-wheel operation in that business to be able to be qualified for this report. It comes out of our audience at Future Commerce, which is a global audience of 50,000 executives who want to see around the next corner. Those executives, again, are in the work of e-commerce every single day. We feel like right now the conversation in our ecosystem is really focused on Black Friday, Cyber Monday. But getting our heads up a little bit and seeing out into the future, this will be the first Black Friday, Cyber Monday where we're piloting a lot of content and creative with AI. I want to know what they're using right now and what their plans are around the creation of job roles and the changing nature of their business. And so that's what we set out to explore here. Let's dive in a little bit.
So when we conducted the survey, we actually found some really, really interesting themes emerge. So the first that we found was that people are embracing AI. And I think,
shocker,
by mere fact of this conference, we can all see that this is happening. Everyone you talk to, whether it be your in-laws or your friend from high school, everyone's interested.
Yeah.
In ChatGPT and what generative AI can do. But it's not just friends and family that are playing around with it. It's everyone in business too. And we're gonna get a little bit deeper into that in just a second. The second is omnipresence. So not only is everyone talking about it, it's actually actively being used. Mm-hmm. And in your roles, in fact, a lot of you are already using it, and that's probably why you're here. You might not be using it in an authorized way, but you're definitely using it. Philip?
And the other part is that it has real utility. Right, there are a number of tools that we're using. They're constrained to a couple big logos or recognizable names. But it has real utility, and it's driving real value today. So we'll get into that a little bit. What we are seeing, though, is that it's generating a lot of productivity. So you can spend more time arguing on Twitter. And that's what we all really want. No, really, the productivity is actually generating a lot of opportunity to do things in your business that you usually scrape and cut corners on. And we'll get into that in just a moment here, too. And lastly, we're seeing a lot of the skepticism move into optimism. The skepticism really is, what can this do for my business? The optimism, which I heard in the conversation house that I was part of yesterday, the optimism is, what can't it do? So really, the optimism is, how can we put a line around how we use something so that we have repeatable results and we can put it to work in our business so that we can solve some problems and then move on to other problems that we haven't gotten around to just yet? Let's break it down a little bit. And lots of reading. Maybe you can have ChatGPT summarize this for you a little bit later on. But let's get into it, because I think it's really important to get into some of the data.
Around embracing AI, 3 out of 4 in the past year have been paying attention to it. That probably means the other one person was already paying attention to it before that. Pretty much 100% of people are paying attention to AI. It's just a lot more people are than were before. And attitudes have really shifted since last year. We're talking about ChatGPT being released in late last year. We're talking less than a year out from its release. And we're already seeing people being more curious about it. They're optimistic, they're excited, and they're less skeptical. What does this mean? Well, they're ready to use it. So
and you might say, duh. I think the embrace is really important to look at here, because if you think about other technologies, especially ones that were overhyped, I have a lot of monkey picture NFTs, sadly. But you look at other technologies that have been hyped in our industry. In reality, the embrace here is pretty universal. And that's where this, you know, trend of omnipresence sort of comes in.
Exactly. 91% of our respondents are actively using ChatGPT or some other kind of Gen AI in their day-to-day work, which is wild. If you don't have policies around how to use Gen AI, people are just going to use it. If you do have policies around it, that's great. What I think the takeaway here is people are going to use it no matter what. In fact, not only are people going to use it, if you think about the education system and how people are going through school right now and how my kids are interacting with the internet right now, the next generation of people coming up through your business are actively using AI. There's no way to escape it. You should not wait. This is the takeaway. Do not wait to start employing licensed AI software that you have policies around, so that you can build best practices within your business. Because right now, all of you, I mean, I shouldn't say all of you, there's a few of you that I heard have generated a few best practices within your business. But most of the people that are using it are doing it off one-off ways without anyone's knowledge. And that's not the most efficient way to use a tool in your business.
Yeah. And remember too, there's 300 e-commerce operators. These people are trying to find ways to manage the amount of diversity in their work. And if you have been in digital retail at all, you know that there's a tool for everything. And what we've found in talking to these operators is that, having a tool that's sort of a common interface that allows you to accomplish a lot, this becomes sort of a connective tissue between the disparate pieces of software. So you can accomplish a lot in one place. And that goes back to this idea of shadow use, Brian.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And the other thing that's super exciting, and again, we had a range of different types of roles that took this survey, but 2 out of 3 expect increases in budget for AI this coming year. This is exciting because Bloomreach just introduced a couple of tools to spend money on, and they're going to be phenomenal. So I think that the opportunity here is to look out ahead and say what's available to you, and then start to make some smart investments.
That'll do it for this episode of the Commerce Experience Podcast. If you want more from the Edge Summit, you can visit theedgesummit.com. where you'll find all of these sessions, the full length. You can watch them on demand. Highly encourage you to check it out. That's it. We're wrapping this thing up. And as Brian always says, be safe, be well, and here's to good business.